This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Sevilla win the Europa League as they do every year, seemingly. Jose's winning run in European finals is over. Was it the worst game ever? Is that recency bias? Was Anthony Taylor man of the match, or is that just jingoistic nonsense? Either way, a half-decent year for Gonzalo Montiel and a wonderful moment for Jose Luis Mendilibar. Perhaps we'll all peak at 62. There's an FA Cup final to look forward to. Can Manchester United end City's treble chances? There's some transfer stuff. The Chelsea exodus begins. Postecoglou to Spurs might be a thing. And Mark Clattenburg gets to say, "Gladiators, you will go on my first whistle." All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello.
Hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Good morning, Max.
Hello, Nicky Bandini.
Hi, Max.
And I don't even know if we've got him for the whole of part one, but we've got Sid Lowe for now in a hotel room in Budapest. Hello.
Good morning. Have you looked on the map to work out exactly where in Budapest I am?
Well, yes, Sid is sitting with a hotel room with the map of Budapest behind him, for those of you who weren't on the Zoom call before we started.
Sorry, yeah, that was a really pointless thing to tell you. Yeah.
That's all right. So let's do the Europa League final then first. Sevilla winning 4-1 on penalties after a 1-1 draw with Roma. They've won every Europa League final they've played in, winning 7 out of 7 all in the last 18 years. No other side has won more major European finals in the 21st century. Dale says, is there any better things those on the pod could have done with the 3 days we all dedicated to watching this final? Paul says, was that genuinely the worst European final ever? Also, was it genuinely the longest European final ever? Dan King, the journalist, saying, poor game this, should have gone straight to penalties without even normal time. Sid, was it that bad? I didn't mind it.
No. I say no. Obviously, in some ways it was. But no, in the stadium it wasn't. I suppose because you've got the tension of it, the sense of occasion, the sense that every time someone gets anywhere near the goal, which admittedly didn't happen a huge amount, there was the kind of the feeling that this is the moment. And I suppose when you've got a game where not very much is happening, you feel like anything that does happen will be decisive. That will be it. When Smalling hits the bar in the 147th minute of this interminable game, that could have been it. Although, the other moments when it just about happened, it could have been it. I didn't think it was that terrible, but that was partly the tension of the stadium. It is true, though, I must admit, that the thing that most struck me being in the ground was that every time I looked down, there were at least a dozen people in the technical area in front of the Roma bench. They had 11 on the pitch and 11 in the technical area as well, like playing a little small-sided game in there, all of their own.
Yeah, we had a lovely question from a guy called Ian, who said, "Are there any stats on the distance covered by the Roma bench tonight, and how do they compare to the starting 11?" Nicky, you tweeted that you thought it would be ugly this game, but I don't know if you thought it would be this ugly.
I think Sid actually referenced it in one of his preview pieces that he wrote. I mean, Mourinho's bench for Roma have been like this all season. It's been quite clearly a deliberate tactic to sort of draw attention to the bench and the fuss that's going on there, because that takes the pressure off your players in some way. And we know Mourinho's about this. He's been doing something like that ever since he's been at Chelsea, finding ways to deflect the attention off his players to lighten the load on them, until he decides to throw them under the bus anyway. I expected a not particularly thrilling game. I will say that I expected a not particularly thrilling game between Sevilla and Juventus in the second leg of their semi-final. It turned out to be a really entertaining game, so sometimes you can be surprised. But Roma have not played entertaining football most of the time under Jose Mourinho. What they have done in the cups is played effective football a lot of the time.
It is a brilliant moment for Mendilibar, right? 62. Jose had won more European trophies than he had managed European games, before the game.
When Mourinho won his first with Porto, Mendilibar was managing Lanzarote in Spain's Segunda B, I tend to refer to it as the third tier, but it was a third tier divided by four 20-team groups. So it's anywhere from the third to the seventh tier of Spanish football. He's got actually a fantastic career. I did the stats and I can't remember what it was. It's either 965 or 956. My mind can't remember which way around those numbers went. That was his 965th game last night, Mendilibar and his first final. He has had over 400 games in the First Division, so he's not a total nobody. But it is true that he's always had clubs at the other end of the table, which is one of the reasons why he turned up at Sevilla. Because this is the amazing thing about this. Sevilla brought him in to rescue them from relegation, which he's done. He's been in charge for 16 games and only lost two of them. He's now won the Europa League. He made a lovely line last night because I think there has been a sort of a sense of discovery of Mendilibar, which is a little bit false because everybody knew him. Everyone thought he was entertaining because he's very direct. He's very kind of, he's potty mouthed. He doesn't, he doesn't mess about. He's straight to the point. And but there has been this idea of kind of discovering him and, oh, he's actually quite good. And a little bit like, is he really the man for a club like Sevilla? And he said post-game last night, he said, it's not bad, this, is it? For someone who won the chance to coach Sevilla in a raffle.
Yeah.
and he sort of made that point. And he made the point, I think, after the semi-final, that in a way, this was a demonstration to people that these coaches that people don't talk about, maybe it's actually about opportunity. And he's talked about how he spent a lot of his career going into games worrying, going into games wondering how you avoid defeat. And he said, apart from the first two or three games of Sevilla, when you come in a time of crisis and the team's in trouble near the bottom of the table, he said, apart from those first two or three games, I'm now turning up at games, and this is a new experience for him, thinking, we can win this. And so it was in the end.
Yeah, and actually, Lars, he made the right changes, didn't he? Because Roma were better in the first half. If you're 1-0 down to Jose in a European final, that's bad news. Like, Jose hadn't conceded a goal in a European final since... what, Henrik Larsson, 2003. Henrik Larsson's now 51 years old. And he brought on Suso and Lamela, who did change the game.
Yeah, no, I thought they did. We'll get back to Roma. I was surprised by how they almost sort of declared in the second half and was just sort of, now we're done with this now. Because in the first half, when they were more assertive, Sevilla had trouble. And of course, some of it was Sevilla changing the game, but also, you know, the two central midfielders for Sevilla are both 35 years old. So they're fine athletes for the age, of course. But when Roma were being a little bit more in their face, Sevilla didn't cope super well with that. But Roma sitting back, I thought, really played into Sevilla's hands. And of course, then bringing Suso and Lamela, who were both very lively, onto the field, that worked really well for them in the second half.
Sevilla, it felt to me, didn't really start playing until the board went up and said there were 7 minutes left for the first half. And they played really well for those 7 minutes. And they hadn't really done anything until then. And I thought the player that made it happen in those 7 minutes was Brian Gil. He sort of started getting going. He started getting lively. Of course, he's the one that goes off. And so I must admit, while I think we all expected Suso to come on, while we all thought Lamela would come on at some point, I didn't think Brian Gil would make way that early. Because I'd started to think at the end of the first half, he was the one person, you know, that looked like he was going to make something happen.
And it ends, Baz, with Gonzalo Montiel, who's had a good time this year, hasn't he? And getting another chance to go, I really want to, you know, I want to do some winning penalties in a shootout again, please. Can I have another go?
I think, and I would imagine Anthony Taylor was delighted to get the opportunity to allow him to take that penalty again. I really do. There was encroachment by Rui Patricio. And obviously Roma had already missed two penalties, so who's to say it would have made a huge difference if it hadn't been retaken. But what a season for him, scoring the winning penalty in a shootout for Argentina in the World Cup final and then doing it again for Sevilla at the second attempt in a Europa League final. That's a decent season by any standards, isn't it?
And not being a starter for either of them. So this is a guy that didn't expect to play a major part in either of them. Although about you last night, I felt the fact that the decisive spot kick was given back by the VAR somehow fit the whole night, didn't it? It's like it's perfect. Like, we're not finishing just yet. We've got one more little refereeing moment for you. This game that begins in May and doesn't finish till June. We've got one more little twist at the end for you.
I liked as well, there was a line I saw from an Italian journalist last night that Sevilla got to maintain their perfect record of winning Europa League finals. But in some sense, Jose could still walk away saying, I've never lost a Europa League final because yeah. It was penalties, right? He didn't lose it. So somehow it was the perfect story for this to be resolved one way or another.
Did he say he was robbed afterwards, Nikki? I sort of saw his quotes, but I was so sleepy.
He didn't quite go sort of all robbed, right. But he did give it that Anthony Taylor was refereeing like a Spaniard, you know, saying that he was sort of, which I don't really know what that even means.
Sorry, Nikki, he literally said
did he say
robbed.
The words robbed? I'm sorry.
He said it in a curious way. So what he did is he talked about Anthony Taylor. He talked about refereeing like a Spaniard. He talked about, sadly, we this isn't surprising, or we expected this, or something like that. He said, but in a European game, it's hard to take. And I think what he's saying, why we expected this, but in a European game, it's hard to take, is what he's essentially saying is this has happened to us all year. The time when he actually used the word Rob directly was he was complaining about the club. And obviously, Nicky, you'll know this far better than me. And the idea that he was expressing was, why is it always me that has to defend the boys? And he basically said, I'm tired of being the one that has to come out and say we've been robbed. So obviously he's linking it to last night, if maybe not automatically saying it. But I think we know that he thinks that because, of course, there was then some footage later of him in the car park waiting to speak to Rossetti. And basically, sort of saying effing disgrace. I mean, he did a Drogba on him, basically.
Yeah. I mean, there's echoes here, isn't there, of Antonio Conte and his sort of a monologue he had not long before leaving Tottenham, where he was saying, you know, why is, you know, in England we're not defended, it's me who's got to come out and do this. And it's true, right? Like at different clubs in Italy, there are directors who come out and speak more to the press than perhaps they have at Roma. But also, the reason he's always the one defending them from being robbed is because he always claims that they've been robbed when they haven't been, you know, like,
yeah. And because he wants to be as well, doesn't he?
Yeah,
he likes
like,
that role.
I don't think Anthony Taylor had a perfect night. It was quite a difficult night because there's a lot going on, but I think the biggest decisions he got right, didn't he? I mean, the VAR taking back the penalty was a good decision, I thought, and I didn't think the handball was enough for handball to be a penalty. And
no, exactly. Well, that, and also, regardless of right or wrong, if you look at it from the point of view of, you know, who does it benefit, regardless of whether it's right or wrong, you've got a penalty each, so that's level. Frankly, I think Rakitic is fouled on the Roma goal. I think he's pushed directly off the ball and they score. So you've got three big decisions. Well, there's two gone Roma's way and one gone the other way. Whether or not they're right, obviously, is another issue. I've watched the Sevilla penalty three or four times, and I think it's both a dive and a foul, if you see what I mean. So I don't really know where I stand on it. But
he just gets the ball. He just gets the ball.
But he definitely takes the shin as well, doesn't he? He sort of does, yeah. Both. And I must admit, I honestly don't know what it is. But to be fair, is to be fair to Mourinho a good way to open any statement? anyway, to be fair to Mourinho, what he was saying post-game as well, he said, and this comes back to that idea of refereeing like a Spaniard, he was saying, let's not even talk about this big decisions. Let's talk about the whole thing. And he said, anyone who's been in football a long time, anyone who's played the game, could see right from the start what was happening. I was thinking, could we? I don't know. I mean, I could see some things were happening. I'm not sure if that was one of them.
Lars, there's a question from Matt. Is it time to start calling out Mourinho's behaviour, or is it box office? If the coach of a kid's team acted this way, would that be entertaining if surrounding the ref over and over just harmless shithousing? Or should it be just condemned?
I do feel we reached some sort of peak, sort of divorced dad grassroots football thing when he was calling out the referee in the car park afterwards. I mean, that's proper sort of, yeah, man in Sunday League man who's frustrated with how the way his life is going type of behavior. I find myself, I mean, the shit housing is often a guilty pleasure. And as I said a few weeks back, I'm sort of increasingly more concerned with what's fun than what's good. And it can be fun. But there's also something just slightly pathetic about it all in the game where, again, I think he just got the approach wrong, really. I thought that Roma were in a really good position in this game in the first half against Sevilla. Then they did the Mourinho thing and sat back and didn't play anymore, and it really played into Sevilla's hands. And there were no real... I think the only serious refereeing mistake in this was not sending off more people from the Roma bench. I mean, that was the obvious mistake the referee made. And then you come out afterwards and try to make it about the referee because you couldn't get it done. It's pathetic behavior. Really, and we talk about this a lot, about the culture of abuse of referees. I mean, Mourinho didn't invent it, but he certainly isn't helping. And I think you referenced the sort of a thing Conte said recently. I always come back to the other famous Conte monologue, more specifically about Mourinho, where he says, in the past he was a little man in many circumstances, is a little man in the present, and for sure he will be a little man in the future. I mean, that seems to have pretty much nailed it. Not that Conte is a titan of ethics and himself, but I just found it grim, really. I mean, maybe I'm just bitter because I had to rush home from the dog park to watch this game, and then it was all bad, and then Mourinho behaves like he does. But I don't see the charm of it. I saw quite a few tweets yesterday. Ah, Jose at it again. I think it helps when you basically never have to watch him or his team. And then you sort of read headlines about how he's in trouble for heckling teenagers or wearing a wire, all this sort of nonsense he's gotten up to. But it is just really wearying. I quite like watching football. I find the sort of constant sideshow of Mourinho very not as charming as other people find it.
Well, it's a slightly odd question to ask, should we start calling out Mourinho's behaviour? We've been calling it out for 20 years. I mean, our first encounter, well, certainly my first encounter, was when his Porto team absolutely disgraced themselves in the UEFA Cup final against Celtic in 2003 with their fouling, their time-wasting, their petulance. That's 2 decades ago. It's got worse since. And in the meantime, you know, we called him out when he forced Chelsea physio Eva Carneiro out of a job and had to settle privately with her on the steps of Croydon Court for discrimination. We called him out when the Swedish referee Anders Frisk was forced into retirement after a Chelsea game against Barcelona in which Didier Drogba was sent off. Drogba and Mourinho were both very critical of him. And while Drogba subsequently apologised, UEFA found that Mourinho wasn't directly responsible for forcing Frisk into retirement. So, you know, we've called him out for years. And I think what went on last night, at the risk of turning into swoony Victorian lady with a fit of the veil, it was disgraceful. If every team and every back and their backroom staff behaved like Roma did last night, I would completely lose all interest in football very quickly. And I don't think I'd be alone.
Yeah, I couldn't help finding it, some of it. You know, I maybe I grew last. I don't watch Roma every week. When Roma scored, when Jose's sort of wandering off doing something, I'm like, oh, I quite enjoy watching that. And
he was an old man who'd walked out his front door and discovered there was a street carnival, and he was like, what are all these kids doing running around? And sort of grumbling to himself and then getting back in the house again.
I mean, I suppose, and yeah, Nicky, like he sort of brought the Roma fans together, right? You know, in winning the Conference League. I think the Stadio Olimpico was full, wasn't it, yesterday? Like that is a power he has. And God, we're just talking about him. Like, there's lots of players, there's lots of stories. And I mean, maybe that's our fault rather than his.
Look, I mean, there's a phrase in Italian that gets brought up semi-often. La finale non si gioca, si vince. You don't play a final, you win it. And like, I think that mentality, which you can attribute as a very Italian mentality, I think, honestly, like, step aside from the fact that none of us have a horse in this race, that we're journalists. If you're a fan, that's all you care about, actually. Like, all you care about when your team goes to a European final is, did we win it or not? Like, how it happens is going to get forgotten. If you win it, you're going to enjoy that trophy forever. And Roma, again, I think there's sometimes a disconnect in how they're perceived internationally, weirdly, with how they're perceived by their own fans even sometimes. They are a big club. They're, of course, a huge club that have had huge players, but they haven't won a lot. And they had never won a UEFA trophy like the Conference League last season. I know it's only the Conference League, but it's still a European major trophy that they won because Mourinho was there. And he then took them to another final. So I don't think it's that shocking, actually, that fans want to get behind the guy who's bringing them this success. That's what football fans, not the neutrals, the ones who are following their team, want is their team to succeed. Of course, everyone feels happier when their team is doing it in a beautiful way and playing everyone off the park. But first and foremost, I think fans want to win games. Now, of course, he didn't win this one, so it's much easier to sort of turn around and be critical. And he deserves criticism. I completely agree with Lars's assessment of things he got wrong in this game. I think that, strangely, for all that I think Sevilla did dominate a lot of this game, Roma had the better chances. And I think if Roma had had the courage to go for the jugular after taking the lead, they might have done the job. They might have finished it off. And I also think it's fair to sort of acknowledge that this team has been, it's one really technically excellent player is Paolo Dybala, and without him, there's a huge drop-off. And Andrea Belotti had that chance, which he couldn't take because, with the best one in the world, he's 2023 Andrea Belotti. I mean, he's had better years in his career when he was younger, but he hasn't scored goals consistently in a long time.
He's a big lump.
Tammy Abraham hasn't been scoring goals consistently this season. There aren't players there that are really sort of in great form for the most part. And getting this team actually, with how it's looked in Serie A lately, to a European final is a feat. Now, of course, turn around and look at Sevilla getting to a European final while 11th in the league on their third manager of the season. It's even more extraordinary.
A word on Sevilla, because there are lots of nice stories. You know, Navas to have won this when he was, 17 in, 06, was it? And, you know, he doesn't look quite as young, but his piercing eyes make him look younger than, you know, the other old men who were on the pitch there. Rakitic was great. Ocampos is this sort of player I didn't know a lot about, but I think it was Lars, or I can't remember, someone saying he's got about 8 lungs, like just never stops. And Bono's, one of his penalty saves was unbelievable, actually, in that shootout.
There was a lovely moment in a press conference after the game. I assume you're talking about the one that hits the post. And Bono was asked, sorry to ask you this, did you actually save that one? And he said, if you watch the footage, I think you'll see. And then him and the manager sort of have a bit of a giggle. And then some journalist from the back shouts, yes, you saved it. And he said, well, you know, that's for you to say. And sort of really enjoyed himself. He is curious because it's switched round. So Sevilla have Marco Dimitrovic and Yassine Bono as their goalkeepers. Now, in theory, second choice is playing in the Europa League and the first choice goalie plays in La Liga. When Mendilibar came, he swapped them around. He made Marko Dimitrovic, who wasn't first-choice goalkeeper, the first-choice goalkeeper in the league. He's the goalie he had when he was at Eibar. And the relationship was really, really good. And Mendilibar admitted that he gets the teammates going, you and your sort of, essentially saying, you and your bald lover. You know, you're putting this guy in the team because you love him. And Bono loses his place. And Mendilibar's admitted that Bono had found that quite difficult to accept, that he'd lost his place in La Liga. But of course, in return for losing your place in La Liga, you become the second-choice goalkeeper. So you become the first choice goalkeeper in the Europa League. It's turned out brilliant for him.
Yeah.
Poor old Dimitrovic is thinking, you bastard, couldn't I have continued being the substitute?
Can I just ask one question? It's sort of a tactic-y, quite boring question. But you interviewed Mendilibar not too long ago, Sid, and he basically said that he only has one tactic, get the ball out wide, send in crosses, and try and score. And he said, you know, we are the easiest team on paper to beat because everyone knows how we're going to play all the time. And that's how they played last night, and that's where the goal came from. Why can't teams stop them?
I think because there is this whole kind of storyline around Mendilibar as being Mr. Simple. You know, get it wide, get it in the box, get it wide again, get it in the box again, get it wide, get it in the box again, go direct, don't piss around at the back, everything's simple. And I think one of the answers to your question is that actually it's not quite as simple as it looks, that there's a lot more work behind it than it looks like. But this narrative persists. But one of the reasons this narrative persists is precisely what you've been saying. Because the person who most does this, the person who most kind of talks down Mendilibar, the person who most says, this is just easy, really, is Mendilibar himself. And that's something about the personality, the way he talks. He kind of removes that from himself. I think that's a big part of the reason why. And you know, that's it. If you look at, for example, his Eibar team, the statistics will show you, you know, those statistics, for example, about the average height of your defensive line was higher than anyone else in La Liga. You know, they pushed, squeezed the team really, really high. Yes, it was relatively simple. And he had Brian Hill then. It was open the wing, get Brian Hill to go at people, get someone go outside, get the cross in the box. If not a huge amount of precision, get a huge amount of volume of attacks. And I suppose the answer is, why doesn't anyone stop this? Because it's not that easy to do. And I suppose the other simple thing is, if you're putting the ball in the box a lot, that's not something it's easy to stop. You know, maybe it's something easy to head away, but it's not something easy to stop the ball actually going in. And I think that's part of it. There's also an emotional side to this. And again, it's Mendilibar downplaying himself. But there was a line the other day where he was asked, you know, how do you explain this turnaround? And he said, well, because these guys are fucking brilliant. These guys are great players. And they shouldn't have been where they were before. And in a way, all I've done to him is turn up and say, lads, you know how to do this. On you go. Now, again, that's
the Spanish Harry Redknapp. Well,
there is a risk of him sounding like a terrible dinosaur. But and there's a degree of that, but there's a sort of a charm that goes with it as well. But I think one of the reasons for that is that he himself projects that. So he sort of undoes himself. But that's part of the way that one of the reasons why he's successful.
All right, Sid, you can go away now. Thanks for your time, mate.
Thank you. Cheerio.
That'll do for part one. We'll look ahead to the FA Cup final in part two. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We have an exciting announcement to make, Barry. We have written an annual, the Guardian Football Weekly annual, including some great...
Oh, it's not the Guardian Football Weekly annual, Matt. This is the announcement, and you've already got the title wrong. It's called the Guardian Football Weekly book.
Ah, oh, book. It's a book. Yeah, my apologies.
You know, I can see how you might... forget that.
Is it a book? Is it?
And I think it just goes to show how much work you put.
Oh,
in.
You did absolutely fuck all.
That's such a lie. Such a lie.
Let's start again. Jonathan Wilson has written a book.
No, Jonathan Wilson has passively aggressively forced us into helping him write a book, although he did write sizable tracts of said book.
Anyway, it's got some great content. Max and Barry's Blind Date, Mark Langdon's World of Meat, Johnny Lou's You Are the Ref, Ben Fisher's Guide to Car Parks, Philippe Auclair's No Holds Barred Account of Everything That's Wrong with Football, Redacted, an exclusive David Squires cartoon, The True Story of the Great Betrayal, amongst many other things. And you can learn about all the panellists too. If you pre-order on the Guardian Bookshop, you'll get 20% off. It is out on the 28th of September. So a great stocking filler. You can pre-order the link in the show notes. We'll all tweet out the link for it. Or you can go to this. They've really worked on a really easy website for you. GuardianBookshop.com/the-football-book-9781783352906. So anybody, could everybody please buy a book? Because I think if we sell a million copies, it'll be worth all the work that we put in. But it does look great.
I think we need to sell about a million copies for any of us involved to start making money out of it.
Correct.
Wait, hang on. We can make money out of it. I didn't know.
No, not you.
Not you.
I wrote a page.
That is true. Please, everyone, buy it. It will be a wonderful read for the rest of your lives, and certainly easier to read than anything else Jonathan Wilson has written. The FA Cup final, Manchester City versus Manchester United. Is this game, Lars? It feels to me like it's for Manchester United to stop Man City winning the treble. Is that sort of the biggest part of this whole game, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? I mean, they have, of course, already lifted one trophy this season, Manchester United. They made the top four. There is a sense that this season has been progress. Winning the FA Cup, of course, would be a lovely sort of capper to that. But let's be honest, it is primarily about stopping Man City winning the treble. I think that's entirely fair to say, because of course that's one of the more famous achievements of the modern Manchester United, is winning the treble. They don't want anyone else to do it. It's understandable.
Can they stop them, Baz?
They can. City are beatable. We've seen this season. Brentford beat them twice. I was sort of thinking to myself, you know, how can Manchester United win this game? And I devised a plan. But unfortunately, my plan involves them fielding at least 15 players, and that's not allowed for all the things they need to do and the running around they need to do. The one thing I will say is that, as maligned as he is, and for all that he hasn't been a great success since arriving at Manchester United, I think that in the unlikely event of Manchester United winning this game, Wout Weghorst will make headlines. He will be an integral part of any win. I think his astonishing work rate will be crucial. He may not start. He probably won't start. Yeah, I think this could be Weghorst's time to shine in a United shirt.
It would be great if that's what happened. I mean,
well, it would be really great insofar as for the first time in quite some time, I will sound like I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but it's quite a bold prediction. With all the players at your disposal, picking out Weghorst as well to be the hero is bold, isn't it? It seems so hard to look past City the way they're playing, Nikki. I mean, do you give Manchester United or Inter more chance of stopping the treble?
God, that's an interesting way of framing it. I mean, I think it's worth reminding ourselves United did beat City in January. We're not talking about ancient history. And it was sort of...
Oh, that does feel like ancient history to me.
I'd completely forgotten
yeah, me
that.
Me too.
I brought up Brentford. I forgot United had actually beat.
And, you know, it was not like a total smash and grab either, was it? I mean, they definitely like gave up all of the ball, but City didn't have an overwhelming number of chances in that game, and that is a model for beating City. It's not necessarily a model that you can clap your hands and say, right, we'll just do that again and it'll be easy. But that wasn't like a terrible City team or anything. It had Haaland and it had De Bruyne in it. It was a strong City team and they still beat them. So it's not impossible, and I think probably the answer, much though I would love to believe in Weghorst's prediction, the answer in my mind probably does go through the same players that the goals came from that game, which is Fernandes and Rashford, who is where you imagine United goals coming from. And I think that's really sort of one of the big issues, isn't it? When you look at United's attack and you're thinking of, they're not going to dominate a game against City. That's 100% in my mind. And it's completely the same question for Inter. Inter are not going to dominate a game against City, and Inter are very aware they're not going to dominate a game against City. You then look for what's your path to winning a game? And I think that Inter, when I look at them, honestly, do have paths to winning a game. The paths to winning a game revolve around the fact that Lautaro Martinez is playing some of his best football in an Inter shirt right now and is scoring brilliantly. And when he's on song, I think he's capable of being really, really top tier in the world kind of striker. His problem is he goes in these long droughts, but when he's on, he's brilliant. And you've got depth that's allowed Inter to get through the season less knackered than some teams who've played so many games, because they've been able to switch in Dzeko and Lukaku alongside Lautaro, because they've been able to have this midfield where, because Calhanoglu was playing so well, Brozovic didn't play as often as he would have to. And you know, when you've had injuries and Mkhitaryan and players going out, then you can even sort of bring Brozovic off the bench. They did in the semi-final. So Inter, I can see their outs. But I think that both of these teams are in the same position, which is City are better than us. City are going to have more of the ball than us. And so how do you navigate that reality and still find a way to win the game? And yeah, to bring it back to the FA Cup final, I think probably you're asking Fernandes or Rashford to do your moments of magic for you.
So the sort of metaphor that I think Jonathan Wilson of this parish has used at least once, possibly more than once, is that Man City are like the Death Star. They're this sort of terrifying the machine of doom that has a fatal flaw. There is the exhaust port. You know, you can't get at them on the counterattack. My concern this spring is that I worry that they've been more like the second Death Star, is that they've kind of covered up the things, and it's not that easy to get to the fatal flaw, and that to get past them, whoever are to beat them has to form some sort of informal alliance with the Ewoks at some point to get help. And this is where I can't find a footballing equivalent for the metaphor. I'm not sure who the Ewoks would be and how that would work, because they do seem to have closed off this sort of counterattack thing. After
is that Weghorst an Ewok? Is that what I'm
that
hearing?
Doesn't work at all. Like he's much more of a Wookiee than an Ewok. Maybe Garnacho. Like he's quite sort of speedy. Maybe he is the Ewok. Because the counterattacking thing, the Man United game you mentioned, I'm just kind of looking at reminding myself. This was before Guardiola had struck upon this sort of genius little change in tactic. You know, Cancelo was still there. And they hadn't started doing this sort of John Stones hybrid center half type of thing, which has really just made everything come together this spring, and it's made everything work for them. And it's just so difficult to get past Man City right now. I'm not sure, but if Baz is shouting Wout Weghorst, let me fly the flag for Garnacho. I think the pace of Garnacho could be something that could unsettle Man City possibly.
But inherently don't want any team to win the treble, right? Because you want trophies to be shared around. You don't want a team to dominate. But would it be bad if Man City won the treble in pure footballing terms, Barry? Like, I didn't want Manchester United to do it, but perhaps once every quarter of a century, it's okay for a team to win everything because it's like a story that we can go back to and sort of talk about.
No, I don't think it would be good because they're a state-owned club.
I mean, and I agree with you completely, but...
I don't want state-owned clubs to monopolise all the tournaments because that is obviously bad for football.
It's a good answer to perhaps a silly question, but that's why I sort of tried to caveat it in terms of pure footballing terms. You know, here is a brilliant football team who probably deserve it, Lars?
Yeah, no, I'd throw in, being no friend of the state-backed clubs either, I worry more about the fact that they've won 5 out of 6 Premier League titles and that they regularly get to 90-plus points. I think that's creating a sort of... I mean, are we the Bundesliga? Is the sort of the territory we're getting towards now. That they also get it right in the cup competitions. I feel like there's always more variance there. And that's maybe that's not something that worries me quite as much. Man City have been one of the best teams in Europe so many years now that they kind of do a European trophy on top of it, and they've won a bunch of cups. So, I mean, that's not... It is what it is. They're probably the best team in Europe right now.
I think it's sort of when you talk about just like the narratives of these things, and you're talking about United trying to deny them the treble, it's sort of fun in a narrative sense that you go from United, the team that's trying to stop you winning treble, to Inter, who of course have also won a treble, the only Italian team to have won a treble, and who there's this other curious sort of little piece of European history that Milan is the only city that's got two different teams that won the European Cup. And so if you beat Inter, you make Manchester the second city that's won with two different teams that won a European Cup. So it does feel like a series of boss battles that have been lined up in sort of a narrative sense for City to get there.
Who is M. Bison in all of this? Away from the final, Man City have opened talk with Chelsea over a deal for Mateo Kovacic as the Chelsea summer clear out begins. You sounded like it was like a positive noise you made there, Lars.
I just think it's kind of interesting. I can imagine him being the sort of this season's Akanji, in the sense that he's a player you don't think of as being a sort of spectacular footballer, but you could completely see him fitting in at Manchester City. You know, he's very tidy on the ball. He's a clever footballer. He's quite good at a lot of things. I can imagine him slotting into that Man City midfield and being a very useful player for them. Yeah, for sure.
Meanwhile, the Telegraph reporting that Mason Mount has agreed personal terms to join Manchester United. I'm sort of surprised he's leaving Chelsea, Baz.
I'm not. There's quite a long list of Chelsea players heading for the exit door this summer, and most of them are homegrown and they need to be sold because any money that made in their transfers is total profit, and Chelsea desperately need to balance the books.
Yeah, I don't know why. Maybe just because he feels like sort of heir apparent to your sort of Terrys and Lampards in terms of how Chelsea he is. And, you know, even if all the sense is to move him on, I just sense that he could be really good for Manchester United. He's a really good footballer. Yes, Lars.
But isn't this also a case of him being, victim's totally the wrong word, but it's a consequence of the shifts of regimes there. You know, he has seen his teammates sign massive new contracts in the sort of latter stages of the Abramovich era. Now there's been a change of ownership and the new owners want to bring down the wage bill a little bit and sign longer contracts on not as good terms. And since so suddenly he's being offered money that's considerably less than some of the teammates he has were offered, and he's got 1 year left on his deal, and he's kind of thinking, well, if I can make more money elsewhere and find a club that appreciates me, why not explore the options? It makes sense in that regard.
I've had a direct message from Barca Jim, friend of the pod, parental advisory here, everybody. I'm fucking holding you personally responsible if Ange goes to Spurs. I'd increase security at Football Weekly live gigs if I were you. I will never fucking forgive you. Jim, of course, a Celtic fan. He's emerging as the preferred candidate for the vacant Spurs job. I mean, he's not the first preferred candidate. Sky Sports News previously reported that he was on the list of prospects alongside Roberto Di Zerbi and Marco Silva. There was always Arne Slot. I've forgotten about 10 others. Nagelsmann, Garcia. He spoke before Celtic's final league game of the season, asked if he thought about his future beyond the summer. No, because I know that's not how football works. I've been asked about these things plenty of times. What's important for me is the here and now. I've never planned anything in my football career. You can't, as a manager, chart a course for yourself to be in a certain position in a certain time. I think, Barry, he would be perfect for Tottenham.
So do I, but it's interesting to see that an awful lot of Tottenham fans do not want him, and they don't want him for the same reason that an awful lot of Celtic fans who now adore him and worship him, I think Barca Jim among them, didn't want him when he was linked with the Celtic job. He's proved all those Celtic fans wrong. Whether or not he'll get the opportunity to prove the naysayers among the ranks of Tottenham supporters wrong remains to be seen. I think it is hilarious that so many Tottenham fans think he's beneath their club. You know, after the years, stars of success they've endured and the banter era of Mourinho and Conte, for them to look sniffy and think, oh, well, he's only done really well in Japan and with Australia and in the Scottish Premiership, he's not good enough for us, is... They are deluded.
No, I agree. And also, if after the utter misery of the Conte and Mourinho eras haven't taught you that a big name and a shiny CV isn't always the answer to everything, then you're never going to learn that, ever. I haven't watched Celtic as closely as others, of course. Whenever I've seen them under Ange, I've thought this is a team that hangs together well, where people know their jobs, that have a very clear tactic, a very clear identity. And whenever I've heard him speak about anything, I think he comes across incredibly well, like an incredibly solid guy. So on the basis of that alone, I'd be cautiously optimistic if he went to Tottenham.
Yeah, and if he took the job, he'd actually want to be there, which is a marked improvement from the previous team manager.
Just to agree with you, like, I think that's like such a it's like an obvious point, but a very profoundly true point. Like, I do think, like, having a manager who comes in who's like seeing this as a step they're excited to make in their career, rather than I'm just going to go there and like put up with it because I think I'm more important than it. Of course that makes a difference to how good of a job they do, because they're people, not robots.
Yeah, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do a bit of Serie A. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Nicky, talk to us about Luciano Spalletti. He just wants a rest. It's quite refreshing to hear someone say that. I mean, I completely agree with him. Me too.
He just wants a rest. I do wonder if he would want a rest as much if his employer hadn't turned around and said, we're going to keep paying you the same amount that you're getting paid now, which happens to be less than half what the best managers in the league are getting, even though you've just won us the Serie A title for the first time in 33 years. I wonder if his motivation to rest might have felt different if he felt like his boss was a bit more respectful of what he'd achieved at the club. But yes, it seems very much that because Napoli have taken their option for a year extension on his contract, that Spalletti is not especially excited to carry on right now, and De Laurentiis is going to not force him to carry on, and so we'll get this very, very Italian situation of manager goes off on gardening leave for a while unless someone comes in and stumps up an amount of money that makes it worth releasing him. But I mean, look, I'm certain this year has been extremely draining for him. Luciano Spalletti is a very high energy character in everything that he does, and he has achieved something that was extraordinary. The relationship between him and De Laurentiis hasn't been particularly easy for a while, even before this season. So I think he probably is quite happy to go back to his farm in Tuscany and put his feet up for a little bit.
Oh, that's so idyllic, doesn't it? What do you think happens to Napoli now? Does it feel like a good time to go in there? You sort of think it isn't.
I think there's so much unknown about this summer in with Napoli. Obviously, De Laurentiis has come out quite bullish already about we don't need to sell Victor Osimhen and all of this, but you just don't know how this summer's going to play out. There's going to be a market for Osimhen, and the reality is that De Laurentiis has made aggressive noises before and still sold players like Cavani. When Cavani left, he said he didn't want to sell him, but when the offer's right, the offer's right. There isn't a release clause for Osimhen that's so easily triggered, but there is, for instance, for Kim Min-jae in defence. So there's going to be departures from that team, and there's a manager that's leaving. You'd have thought there will be some money to reinvest, and at least any money raised from sales can be reinvested, because they're actually quite a tight ship, Napoli. They tend to run at with their books fairly balanced outside of COVID, when everyone went a bit wonky. And of course, they've qualified for the Champions League, won the league again, so they're going to have good prize money this season. But it's a very uncertain situation. Of course it is, because you're saying goodbye to your manager and you don't know how many of the players that just won your league are going to go.
Can I ask about Juve? They obviously had their 15 points taken away, then given back, then 10 points taken away. Is that the end of it, or do they get the 10 back and then it's 5 and then 0? Like, what
it
happened?
It seems very much like that'll be the end of that story. So of course, this is incredibly complicated and longer than you want me to get into right now, but there have been parallel cases going on for them. This case that they will assess the 10-point penalty is the plusvalenza, the capital gains case, in which they're basically accused.
Oh, right. It's not connected to the 15-point.
That's the 15-point penalty. The 15-point penalty was assessed for, effectively, the accusation is that they deliberately overinflated the numbers on their accounts by putting false values on players. That's the plusvalenza, I guess, thread of the case. And that's what they were charged on by the sporting courts. And that is what they got. 15-point penalty that was then suspended and then eventually reassessed to the 10-point penalty. And in theory, they could still appeal that back to the Italian Olympic Committee. But it seems they're not going to. And part of the reason that I would say they're not going to is because there was a separate thread of accusation against them, which relates to wages deferred during COVID pandemic. Now, Juventus put out this statement, which went to the stock market. They are listed on the stock market, saying that they were going to defer a certain amount of player wages. And again, the accusation, this is ongoing in legal courts, is that they actually didn't give up that much of their wage. They gave up 1 month's wages instead of 3 months' wages. And that's a legal case that will still play out, because misleading the markets is a crime. But the sporting aspect of that trial has now basically been resolved with a plea bargain, with Juventus saying, okay, we'll accept a great big fine and then we'll call that the end of it. And effectively, it feels like what's happened is that a truce has been reached between the Italian Football Federation and Juventus, where Juventus said, look, we're not going to appeal again against this 10-point penalty. We're going to let that stand. We're going to accept we're not in the Champions League this season, but we want to resolve this wage case situation now so it doesn't drag into next season. That's basically the point we've got to.
Slightly less complicated, but probably more fun. Yeah, the Serie C playoff. I don't know if you've seen this, Nikki, have you? After the Lecco president. Thank you. Tell us about him.
Yeah, I don't have all the details on this story. I'm really sorry, but yes, coming onto the pitch in his mobility scooter to harangue the referee at full time was quite a visual.
It's an amazing video. Yeah. Well, he apparently according to a few people on Twitter, and there's a video of it. He took to the field with his walking stick to confront the referee. He was sent off. Then he came back on his mobility scooter to give the opposition keeper some verbals. So he's just a man on a mobility scooter just poodling around the pitch with the security guard near him. You know,
that'll be Jose in 20 years.
It's his club. He can do what he wants. Serena Wiegmann announced the England women's squad, of course, that depleted by injury. I think Beth England, the Spurs striker, coming in is sort of the big story for that. No Steph Horton. Robin Cowan is on the show on Monday. We will talk about that in detail there. Good news from Luton Town. They tweeted that Tom Lockyer will be allowed to leave hospital and return home. You know, of course, remember he collapsed early on in that playoff final and watched his team be victorious from his hospital bed with his family. It was an amazing photo. And to Mark Clattenburg, who tweets, contenders ready, gladiators 3-2-1, looking forward to working with all the contenders and gladiators for the new series of the show. I hope to do John Anderson proud. Do we think Baz Clattenburg for Anderson is a good that works, doesn't it?
I loved Gladiators growing up, and then they rebooted it, and I actually knew one of the
Wooga.
I knew one of the gladiators in the reboot in the 2000s. But what I really want to know is whether Spartan, Rod Bradley, also Spartan. But I really want to know if Wolf, who was like the old man when they did it the first time, and even older man when they rebooted it, I want to know if Wolf is coming back for one more go.
Well, that's a good question. The Wolf man, he was good with the crowd, but he was a sort of a love-hate figure, wasn't he, Wolf? I'm just trying to find out how old Wolf is.
He's probably in his 60s.
Barry, you don't seem moved, but Michael Van Wyk is his name. He's now 70.
70?
So, that's a stretch to have Wolf. He doesn't have quite as much hair. It says here, in 1994, Wolf played one match reserve team game for Gillingham, playing for 73 minutes against Cambridge United reserves before going off injured. The match attracted a crowd 10 times the average for the club's reserve team games. After Gladiators ended, he moved to New Zealand and opened a chain of gyms. So if you go to a gym that is run by Wolf the Gladiator, and you're one of our Kiwi listeners, please let us know. Aaron says, "Hi Max, I stumbled across your name in the references section of an academic paper I was reading this week for my PhD studies. The study I was reading is called There He Goes, The Influence of Sports Journalism of Fabrizio Romano on Twitter and Its Implications for Professionalism, published in the respected academic journal called Journalism and Media by Dr. Simon McKennis. One of the references of the study is a piece that you wrote for The Guardian in February called An Agenda Against Your Football Club, If Only We Were That Competent. It looks quite cute seeing Rushton M and Rushton 2023 in a fancy academic article. It makes you seem like a tenured professor at an Ivy League university, Dr. Rushton." Oh, well, you never know. Could happen, couldn't it? And Brett says, "Hi, Max. Last night I had a dream that I was watching you on TV as the new Chelsea manager. Things had not gone well, apparently, as you were being hounded by a baying mob while frantically leaping amongst blue plastic seats while the camera struggled to keep up. I remember thinking, how did Max get that job and why on earth did he take it? He seemed so nice as the screaming hordes closed in. I never usually remember my dreams. Perhaps it's time we all had a break. See you in 6 weeks," says Brett. That's very weird. If you are dreaming about any panellist, you are allowed to take 6 weeks off. Anyway, that'll do for today. Thanks, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Baz.
Thank you.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove with Arif Islam. Our executive producer is Christian Bennett. We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.